From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, novelist E.L. Doctorow tells us how he mixes history and fiction, a technique he used in such novels as Ragtime and Billy Bathgate. Also today, we meet Leanne Schreiber. She was the first woman sports editor at the New York Times. She says she was never able to stand the sight of her mother in pain. Her new memoir is about watching her mother die of cancer. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new albums from drummer Mel Lewis, and TV critic David Bianculli checks out Public Television's documentary on the rise and fall of Manuel Noriega. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. President Bush unveiled his fiscal 1991 budget proposal today. It contains no new taxes, but does call for extending existing taxes due to expire. It also proposes new or increased user fees for federal services. The $1 trillion, $230 billion blueprint also boosts spending for education, the environment, and the war on drugs. At a Pentagon news conference today, Secretary Dick Cheney outlined a defense budget of $306.9 billion. That represents a cut of 2% after inflation had been factored in. But NPR's Neil Conan reports that the fight on the defense budget is just beginning.
Secretary Cheney said this budget begins to reflect what he called phenomenal changes in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and there are real cuts. Two army divisions will be disbanded, the Navy will retire two battleships, two nuclear-powered cruisers, and eight nuclear-powered attack submarines. There will be cuts of 38,000 uniformed personnel and 22,000 civilian workers. Production lines for the M1 tank, the Apache helicopter, and the F-14 and F-15 fighters will be closed. And the secretary challenged Congress to go along with recommendations to close 35 military bases in the U.S. and cut back operations at 20 more. Congressional critics are already saying that the budget does not come close to reflecting the real change in the threat in Europe. Likely targets of congressional cuts include the B-2 stealth bomber, two mobile land-based missile systems, and the Strategic Defense Initiative. Star Wars research is up almost $1 billion over last year. This is Neil Conan reporting.
One day after opponents staged an anti-government protest in Romania's capital of Bucharest, supporters of the interim National Salvation Front staged a counter-demonstration. As the BBC's Jane Peel reports, violence broke out at today's rally.
The streets of Bucharest have been packed with people shouting words of encouragement for the front, which the opposition says is influenced by communists. Thousands of people, most of them factory workers, arrived in buses, lorries, and even on forklift trucks. Others are reported to have traveled by train from as far as 600 kilometers away. Some of them surrounded the headquarters of two of the main opposition parties. There were angry scenes outside the National Peasants' Party building. Windows were smashed and the leader of the party and the prime minister who was meeting him had to be driven away with an armored escort. And supporters of the front stormed the National Liberal Party headquarters, tearing down its banner. There were allegations that the front organized the rallies itself and gave workers time off to attend.
Jane Peel reporting from Bucharest. President Bush gave a speech to the National Association of Broadcasters in Washington today. The president declared that the world increasingly is on the side of God, and he lauded the role, of religion in the democratic revolution sweeping Eastern Europe. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 6 points today. It closed at 2553.38. Volume was 150 million shares. This is NPR News. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a new drug to treat a dangerous complication of AIDS. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
The new drug is called fluconazole, and it can now be used to treat a brain infection called cryptococcal meningitis. This potentially deadly complication of AIDS is now treated with a drug that has so many problems, it's been nicknamed Amphoterrible. This old drug must be given intravenously over long periods of time. This is not only expensive and cumbersome, but many people get infected from the IV line. Worse, it has strong side effects. But the new drug, fluconazole, is a pill and with relatively few side effects. So AIDS doctors say it should make life a lot easier for people with cryptococcal meningitis. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
A judge in Alaska has upheld the state's right to try Joseph Hazelwood, the fired captain of the supertanker Exxon Valdez. As his trial, stemming from the nation's worst oil spill, got underway today, Exxon and Alaska officials were still arguing over whether the cleanup was complete. Hazelwood is charged with negligence and drunkenness as a result of last year's spill of 11 million gallons of crude from his grounded tanker. Jury selection is expected to take about a week. If convicted, Hazelwood faces up to 7 years in prison and fines of $61,000. The Immigration Service has confirmed that the agency is releasing Central American refugees from detention camps in Brownsville, Texas. Refugee advocates today claimed that the move marked a reversal of a strongly criticized federal policy of holding refugees until their request for political asylum could be adjudicated. But an INS spokesman stopped short of saying the policy had been abandoned. He said detainees were reported released as a cost-cutting measure. Vice President Dan Quayle ended a three-day diplomatic mission today with a stop in Jamaica, where Prime Minister Michael Manley repeated his opposition to the U.S. invasion of Panama last month. I'm Sharon Green, reporting for NPR News in Washington.
I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I've been away for the past few weeks, and I want to thank Sedge Thompson for filling in for me while I was gone. Well, we had planned an interview with Bud Schulberg today. He wrote the screenplay for On the Waterfront, and his novel What Makes Sammy Run has just been republished. But that interview's been postponed for later this week. E.L. Doctorow's latest novel, Billy Bathgate, has just come out in paperback, and we're going to hear an interview I recorded with Doctorow last March when Billy Bathgate was first published. In E.L. Doctorow's novels, real historical figures and imagined fictional characters inhabit the same stories. Anne Tyler described Doctorow as serving as a sort of human time machine, carrying his readers back to the days of the Wild West in Welcome to Hard Times, to the early 20th century in Ragtime, and to the 1930s in Loon Lake, World's Fair, and now Billy Bathgate. Dutch Schultz is one of the main characters in Billy Bathgate. Billy is a teenager from the Bronx who falls in with the famed gangster. I asked E.L. Doctorow to read the opening of his latest novel, Billy Bathgate.
Okay, the very first sentence I wrote in Billy Bathgate is the first sentence that appears in the book, and it actually delivered the character Billy to me. He was sort of built into the diction and the syntax, and even the rhythm of the sentence gave me the way he breathed. Billy is a 15-year-old boy in the Bronx in the 1930s. Who attaches himself to the great Dutch Schultz, the Prohibition and post-Prohibition New York gangster killer. And the book opens with Billy leaping aboard a tugboat where Mr. Schultz is taking one of his henchmen, Bo Weinberg, en route to a ritual drowning in New York Harbor. And this is the way the book begins. He had to have planned it because when we drove onto the dock, the boat was there and the engine was running, and you could see the water churning up phosphorescence in the river, which was the only light there was because there was no moon nor no electric light either in the shack where the dockmaster should have been sitting, nor on the boat itself, and certainly not from the car. Yet everyone knew where everything was, and when the big Packard came down the ramp, Mickey the driver braked it so that the wheels hardly rattled the boards. And when he pulled up alongside the gangway, the doors were already open, and they hustled Bo and the girl upside before they even made a shadow in all that darkness. And there was no resistance. I saw a movement of black bulk, that was all. And all I heard was maybe the sound someone makes who is frightened and has a hand not his own over his mouth. The doors slammed and the car was humming and gone and the boat was already opening up water between itself and the slip before a thin minute had passed. Nobody said not to, so I jumped aboard and stood at the rail, frightened as you might expect, but a capable boy, he had said that himself, a capable boy, capable of learning, and I see now, capable of adoring, worshipping, that rudeness of power of which he was a greater student than anybody, oh, and that menace of him where it might be all over for anyone in his sight, from one instant to the next. That was what it all turned on. It was why I was there. It was why I was thrilled to be judged so by him as a capable boy. The danger he really was a maniac. Besides, I had that self-assurance of the very young, which was in this case the simple presumption I could get away when I would, any time I wanted. I could outrun him, outrun his rage or the rage of his understanding and the reach of his domain. because I could climb fences and hustle down alleys and jump fire escapes and dance along the roof parapets of all the tenements of the world if it came to that. I was capable, I knew it before he did, although he gave me more than confirmation when he said it. He made me his. But anyway, I wasn't thinking of any of this at the time. It was just something I had in me if I could use if I had to. Not even an idea, but an instinct waiting in my brain in case I ever needed it. Or else, why would I have leapt lightly over the rail as the phosphorescent water widened under me, to stand and watch from the deck as the land withdrew and a wind from the black night of water blew across my eyes, and the island of lights rose up before me as if it were a giant ocean liner sailing past and leaving me stranded with the big, murdering gangsters of my life and times.
And that's E.L. Doctorow reading from his new novel, Billy Bathgate. Now, you said the voice came to you with that first sentence. And when I opened your book, the first thing I thought was how different this voice was from the usual staccato, hard-boiled style associated with crime writing and, you know, with gangster figures in American fiction.
Well, I don't think of this as crime writing. And I've never been a particularly fond of the so-called hard-boiled school of work. I've never been that much interested in crime fiction or true crime, nor have I followed the culture of professional criminals in the papers. I think of this as the story of a young man's sentimental education. It's a kind of Bildungsroman. He's a bright, enterprising kid, the ideal. He's curious, he's energetic, he's a lot of wonder for the world. It's just that it's the underworld that he's attached to.
Well, you seem to be very interested in his interest and his attraction to evil and to power.
Well, we all are, I think. We're all attracted to the disreputable. And it counts, I suppose, in part for the tremendous pumping out of stories of criminals, renegades, and the otherwise lawless that we get all the time. There's something atavistic in us that admires rule breakers, transgressors. The more we ourselves are law-abiding and respectable, the more fiercely burns that little light of sneaking admiration for the truly monumental criminal.
Did you have that sneaking admiration for the criminal when you were growing up?
I suppose I must have, in a kind of fearful way. Of course, in those days, criminals were very much more compartmentalized than they are now. They had their place. They killed each other, and not you. If you just stayed out of their way and you didn't try to compete with them, you were relatively safe and could observe their comings and goings and drownings and killings with some impunity. Now there's some question, some blurring of those lines, I think. It's not quite as clear who is exactly criminal and who isn't.
Yeah, and so much of the crime is random.
Random crime and also the kind of crime in which ethical standards are not as visible anymore, so that there's a lot of secrecy in this country. We've had occasions of public officials who've been supposed or sworn to uphold the law who have in fact broken it, and all that kind of thing just leeches it away. It gives you almost a wish for the good old days when a crook was a crook and everyone else wasn't.
Why did you choose Dutch Schultz as the gangster that the main character in your novel apprentices himself to?
That's an interesting question. I think because he was a New York criminal, and I felt a little more comfortable with him. He was also had a more mythical presence in my mind than some of the others. Dutch Schultz was not his real name, you know. His real name was Arthur Fliegenheimer. But he took the name Dutch Schultz because he was such a tough kid. It was almost given to him as an honor by his gang because he got through reform school in such a feisty way. So he took on the name Dutch Schultz, which was the name of an earlier criminal in the turn of the century. And the name stuck. He later came to regret it, saying that if he'd kept with his original name, he wouldn't have gotten as much attention and therefore into as much difficulty. But that the name Dutch Schutz fit the headlines as the name Arthur Fliegenheimer couldn't. And so that was his era.
Was he Jewish?
He was.
Did that figure into your selecting him as the main gangster?
No, I don't think so. I think it may have been something as simple as that I liked the sound of the name, the sound Dutch Schutz. It had a kind of a primeval ring in my mind, I think.
E.L. Doctorow is my guest, and we're talking about his new novel, Billy Bathgate. One of the central incidents of the new novel is a ritual murder in which one of Schultz's henchmen is killed by getting cement overshoes and getting drowned in the ocean. And you write, a ritual death tampers with the universe. I think this idea of the ritual death was something of great interest to you in planning this novel?
Well, it certainly, the book began with an image in my mind of men in tuxedos in black tie on a tugboat. And for the longest time, I didn't know what it meant or why I was thinking of it. And then I realized that they had to be criminals and that one of them was going to kill the other. And that's really the genesis of the entire book. That's the way it began for me. So this was a crucial scene, very seminal scene, and the nature of the ritual, the sort of sad necessity of it sort of seeps through the entire occasion and makes it quite horrifying. And I guess something about that appealed to me as a writer.
Several critics who loved your new novel mentioned that in the first-person narrative of Billy, who's 15 or 16 in the novel, that he uses some words that it's kind of hard to believe he'd have access to, words like empowered and investiture, which were in the reading that you just gave. How did you think that through, about what kind of language to give him, especially with these like bigger words and more?
Well, I must have understood he was smart as a whip. He's a something of a rhapsodist, too. I mean, part of his being is his power to celebrate that, even things even that repel him and make him fearful. He seems to take all of life into himself and embrace it. The capacity for wonder and rhapsody that is reflected in these nice looping long sentences he comes up with. We do learn that a certain crucial strategic point that Billy has used his criminal earnings to get himself through a very advanced high school in New York called Townsend Harris High School, and then into an Ivy League college, which he decides not to name, because in his adulthood, when he's writing this book, he has a certain renown and he doesn't want to be identified. He's rather mysterious, as it turns out. Possibly as an alumnus of whatever Ivy League college it is, he doesn't want to pin the rap on them.
Well, I want to talk with you more about Billy Bathgate and your other work, but first we're going to take a short break. Writer E.L. Doctorow is my guest, and we'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is E.L. Doctorow, whose novels include Ragtime, The Book of Daniel, and World's Fair. His new novel is called Billy Bathgate. Billy Bathgate continues in the tradition, if you'll pardon that word, that you've established in your novels of combining fictional and real historical figures. What is the resonance that you think you can get from a novel by combining those two together?
Well, I don't really know. It's just something that sort of happened. I didn't begin with any aesthetic theory. I think I've since been forced to try to describe or defend this practice many times. I think What I'm doing is dealing with the, in the case of historically verifiable characters, is I'm dealing with the fictions they themselves made of their lives, the extent that they made themselves public and promulgated a myth about themselves, as Dutch Schultz did, as J.P. Morgan did, as Emma Goldman did in Ragtime. You begin with the fictions people create about themselves, and then they're in your realm, you see. And it's quite valid for you to deal with them and take off from that point.
How did you start doing it? How did the idea first come to you?
I don't know when it came to me or how it came to me. I suppose a good scholar who had the interest and thought it was worthwhile could go back through the books and pick out the first moment where a historical character appears in some kind of fictional guise. I do recall a moment in the book of Daniel where he speculates about the character of Woodrow Wilson, which might have given me this tone of mock historical chronicle that I was able to use in Ragtime. I'm not sure of that, though. It may have been earlier. It's hard to know. You know, it's just as Satchel Paige says. It applies to writers, too. You don't look back.
You know, it's the kind of thing you probably see done badly a lot, you know, even on miniseries, where figures from the past are combined with fictional characters and you end up with a kind of hodgepodge of history. Do you ever feel that people who do this kind of thing less well point to you as a defense for what they're practicing?
Well, I suppose all's fair in love and art. I mean, I don't feel I have to defend the miniseries.
Uh-huh.
I also know that novelists have been doing this forever. I mean, Napoleon is in War and Peace. Dumas, a great favorite of mine as a boy, the Cardinal Richelieu is a character in, what is it, The Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers. I mean, it seems to me the point about fiction is it wades right in. It's not a pure form. It's not as pure as music, for instance, which has no words at all. It really mucks about in life. It intrudes in life, in history, and it uses every available kind of data that we have. It uses intuition. It uses fantasy. It uses dream work. It uses history. It uses autobiography. It's all a great big melange of data. And I think the justification for any work is not what theory it uses, but how good the particular book is. I do know that when Ragtime first came out, a lot of people said, well, he can't do this, it's not allowable. Yet writers now sort of routinely base novels on factual, historically verifiable figures. Nobody says a thing about it. So maybe this idea of the strict demarcation between the fictional and the non-fictional is breaking down a little bit, which is probably all to the good, because we all compose our lives every day, every minute of the waking and sleeping, and I don't think that fiction writers should be the only ones to take the rap for that.
Most of your fiction has been set in the past. Do you feel that it's not your calling to write too much in the present?
No, I think I'm always writing about the present.
But through the past?
Through the past, but I just may be a little slower than everybody else.
In what? In...
Well, I'm trying to catch up. You see, I'm running a few decades behind.
Right, okay. You are still a board member of PEN, the International Writers Organization?
Yes, I am.
Why has it been important for you? You've been outspoken on First Amendment issues in this country and on free speech issues in on behalf of writers in other countries as well. Why has that been important to you?
Well, I mean, what is the alternative? The alternative is repression and tyranny and the absence of thought, the absence of life. I think that any writer has to decide at a certain point to commit a certain amount of his time, his effort to this very basic, elementary insistence that such and such a writer shouldn't be in prison, such and such a writer should be allowed back to his own country. Such and such a writer shouldn't be tortured, and certainly not have to be in hiding with a death threat on his head, We see all forms of censorship everywhere all around the world. It's really quite appalling, and people who live by the word seem to me to have a certain obligation to simply point this out and say it's wrong.
Have you ever been afraid to speak or write your own truth?
You're always afraid. I mean, fear is one of the things you have to deal with. The fear of revelation, the fear of self-exposure, the fear of talking out of turn, the fear of offending those around you who may see themselves in your work. These are all the conditions you begin with. And part of becoming a writer is learning to deal with that fear, learning courage, learning the peculiar life of self-revelation. The interesting thing is that when you don't have that fear, you don't have, on the other hand, the feeling of transgression that you need to do anything that's really good. So, my God, I shouldn't be saying this. This is really, really breaking a rule here. I'm really doing something I shouldn't do. So when you have that feeling, which is a bit fearful, and that you plod on through, that usually your best work is accomplished.
There's the fear of embarrassment, you know, that you'll write something that won't be liked or that will reveal something about yourself that you won't want revealed. And then the fear of imprisonment, torture, or death. Do you think it's given writers more courage to watch writers in other countries who have to brave so much to just write what it is that they're writing?
Well, we are very privileged here, of course. We're not physically in danger.
Weren't you one of the writers who was monitored by the FBI back in the 70s?
Oh, yes, but that was a great honor, you see. That to have a file in the FBI is one of the credentials for achievement. It's like the honor roll of American writing. But essentially, nothing comes of that, and I think they've stopped that now. But it's a great privilege to be on the same list with everyone from Theodore Dreiser and Faulkner and Hemingway and Catherine Ann Porter to all the way up to Truman Capote. I mean, it's a wonderful group of names to be attached to. It's kind of literary criticism the FBI does. I'm talking about writers in Korea or Indonesia or... even in England now, there's the tendency to constrict, to create more draconian rules of governmental censorship seems to be on the increase. It's rather alarming. But in this country, I think writers are abused mostly by the censoring of their work, the withdrawal of books from school libraries on the local levels. The book becomes an offense to this or that group of individuals, and the rest of the community is deprived of reading it. That's the kind of danger most of us are in this country. On the other hand, we're all aware, I think, now this Rushdie thing has given us sense of the world community of writers as nothing else quite has. And that's extremely valuable, I think.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
E.L. Doctorow's latest novel, Billy Bathgate, just came out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be South African journalist Rion Malan. His ancestors were among the original Afrikaners. His great-uncle was the principal architect of apartheid. Malan is opposed to apartheid, so he left his country in 1977. He's written a memoir called My Traitor's Heart, A South African Exile Returns to Face His Country, His Tribe, and His Conscience. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Leanne Schreiber writes, age is claiming our parents, AIDS is claiming our peers. Coming up, we discuss Schreiber's new memoir about watching her mother die from cancer. Schreiber is a journalist and was the first woman sports editor at the New York Times. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new albums from veteran jazz drummer Mel Lewis. One has Lewis fronting his big band. The other features Lewis and his sextet. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Noriega Connection. It's this week's offering from Public TV's documentary series Frontline. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Bush officially presented his $1.23 trillion budget today, and the document immediately drew fire on Capitol Hill. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
The fiscal 1991 blueprint brings the federal deficit down below the $64 billion called for in the Graham-Rubin balance the budget law without raising taxes and while adding spending for some domestic programs. But members of Congress complain that the deficit figure is arrived at by combining a set of overly optimistic projections for economic growth and lower interest rates with spending cuts the lawmakers will never accept. On the domestic side, the reductions proposed in this first Bush budget were repeatedly rejected by a bipartisan group in Congress when President Reagan requested them. And in defense, the Congress is howling over a long list of military bases suggested for closure at a time when the dollar amount inked in for the Pentagon is actually higher than last year's level. Battles over these spending cuts plus tax proposals are likely to make consensus on a budget almost impossible, especially in an election year. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Former East German leader Erich Honecker, who was deposed in October after 18 years, was released from a hospital today and promptly arrested. The national prosecutor said Honecker will be tried for treason. A dozen members of the once powerful Communist Politburo have been arrested in the anti-corruption campaign. The State Department had registered its approval today of an accelerated election schedule in East Germany, but is registering concern about the anti-government demonstrations in Romania. Barry Schweid has more.
Secretary of State James Baker and other officials had doubts the communist government in East Berlin could make it through the winter and hang on until the May elections. So when the communists decided to take in opposition forces and to advance the national elections to March, there was great relief. Spokesman Richard Boucher was authorized to say the earlier date means East Germany can move more quickly to a stable long-term regime that's based on the popular will. In Romania, which Baker has thought of visiting next week while in Europe, spokesman Boucher had a different line. He said the U.S. is watching the almost daily demonstrations carefully. He noted the protests are against the predominance of communists in the Bucharest government, and he urged the ruling National Salvation Front not to backslide in moving from revolution to democracy. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
President Bush spoke to religious broadcasters today, telling them that the world increasingly is on the side of God. He also applauded the role that religion has played in the changes in Eastern Europe. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average ending the day down nearly 6 points to 2553.38. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Drummer Mel Lewis's big band is one of the jazz world's great institutions. It's been performing at the Village Vanguard in New York almost every Monday night since 1965, although recently Lewis can't always make it for these dates because he's sick with cancer. For the band's first 13 years, it was co-led by Lewis and trumpeter Thad Jones. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Lewis is an archetypal big band drummer, and Kevin has a review of two new Lewis albums that place him in familiar and unfamiliar settings.
One of drummer Mel Lewis's two new albums on the Music Masters label finds him behind his big band at the Village Vanguard in 1988. That album is called The Definitive Thad Jones, Volume 1. The fact that Lewis is still playing the music of his ex-partner, the late Thad Jones, may surprise some people. Lewis is still bitter about the way Jones walked away from the band in 1978. Mel Lewis has relied on other composers since then, but some of Jones's charts remain in the band's book, like this variation on I've Got Rhythm called Little Pixie. That's nice writing, though it's not too different from some sax ensemble charts Benny Carter composed in the 1930s. It is the kind of arrangement that would sound terrible if the saxophone section wasn't razor sharp in its rhythm and intonation. One reason this 17-piece band sounds so tight is that its key players have been around for so long. Some of them have been there since before Thad Jones left. That's unusual, since turnover in most big bands these days is pretty rapid. Mel Lewis is the other reason the band sounds so good. He's known for his accurate time, which means he can lock onto a tempo and hold it, and for the little asides he plays, which encourage a soloist along. According to one school of thought, some drumming strategies are suited to big bands, and others to small groups, but Lewis doesn't usually draw those distinctions. That's particularly evident on his other new album, The Lost Art, by the Mel Lewis Sextet, which actually involves 7 players. On pianist Kenny Werner's tune Voyager, Lewis plays the same sort of heavy accents he uses to prod the big band. The alto saxophonist is Dick Oates. Lewis's sextet is drawn from the ranks of his big band, and often sounds like a compact version of that orchestra. Their sound can be deceptively large. A good example is the tune One for Max. Baritone saxophonist Gary Smullyan wrote it for Max Gordon, the late owner of the Village Vanguard. I love that little dip the baritone sax takes. In fact, I like this whole album quite a bit, partly because much of the writing is so relaxed and open. Kenny Werner's modified blues Bulgaria features some delicate tom-tom work by the leader, the kind of subtle playing he couldn't get away with in a big band. The trombonist is John Mosca. Thank you. relaxed music like that helps explain why I like Mel Lewis's new small group recording a bit more than his new big band album. The lean ensemble profile lets you hear his splendid drumming a little better.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed two new albums by the Mel Lewis Jazz Orchestra and the Mel Lewis Sextet. Both are on the Music Masters label. This is Fresh Air. At 33, Leanne Schreiber became the first woman sports editor of the New York Times. By 40, she had left daily journalism and was living the life of a freelance writer in rural upstate New York. It was also the time she learned that her mother had pancreatic cancer. From the time of the diagnosis until her mother's death 18 months later, Leanne kept a journal. Her memoir, Midstream, is drawn from these journal entries.
I have never been able to stand the sight of Mom in pain. I respond to it bodily. If she burns her hand on the iron, I wince. If she coughs, my chest heaves. Once, when we were shopping together in downtown Evanston, Mom tripped on a crack in the sidewalk and smashed headfirst into the pavement. My whole body started tingling. And when I saw the fright in her eyes, I almost fainted. The right half of her face looked broken, caved in. And I lied when she asked me if there was a mirror in the shoe store where we waited for an ambulance. I remember the effort I made to keep looking at her as if there was nothing wrong. As if her beauty was intact. I have witnessed only a few rare accidents based over decades of her healthy life. I have never had to repress or even think about my body's impulsive identification with hers. How will I react now that the threats to her are so much more extreme? What help will I be? What comfort can I give if I am simply the mirror of her suffering? I wonder if all daughters feel this. Do we all have to go through a second weaning?
How did you deal with having to watch your mother suffering a lot?
It was, without doubt, the most difficult task that life has ever given me. And I think the first thing that I realized, I think the passage I just read was one that I wrote when I was on the plane from New York to Minneapolis to see my mother for the first time after having learned only days before that she had pancreatic cancer and had been given only months to live. And in anticipation, I thought I would feel as she felt, that the level of identification and vicariousness would be so great that if she were in pain, I would be in pain. But as soon as I faced her, it was just so apparent that what she needed around her was not a mirror, but strength, that it was almost an instinctive response. I saw my father doing the same thing. It didn't require thought. It was just an impulsive reaction to see her in suffering, was to be there as a form of reassurance, to be there as a form of strength, to be there as a vision of a possibility of another way of feeling. And that seemed to be the most helpful thing I could do.
Toward the very end of your mother's life, when her body had begun to completely fail her, you wanted to get her to worry less about her body and to think more about her spirit. How did you go about trying to do that?
Not successfully. My mother was so determined to live. Most people, when they receive the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, are urged to receive it as a death sentence and to accept death within months. She was incapable and unwilling to accept that judgment. Partly what's very hard to understand until it happens is that one can be perfectly fit and healthy, as she was literally weeks before her diagnosis, only weeks before they said that she had 2 months to live, she was walking up and down the hills of Tuscany with me, looking like a woman in her prime, terrifically physically fit. But fitness and basic health are two very different things. But your subjective experience is of your fitness. So she was this immensely fit, young-looking, young-hearted woman. The fact that she was 75 years old made no difference to her whatsoever. It was just as if I had been told I had 2 months to live. I could not accept it. She could not accept it. So she chose a very against-the-odds experimental therapy that was going to take immense courage and stamina on her part to withstand in order to have her very slight chance of survival. She took it. The mental state which was required to survive the therapy required such levels of hope, stamina, and endurance that were valuable at the time, but when it came to the end, when it came to the losing battle, she was incapable of changing gears. She was incapable of saying, okay, I give up. And I think that was very particularly her. I think it was very much the nature of her character. One of the things that happened to me in this process and observing all the members of my family react to this extremity is as I gained a fuller appreciation of the fact that there is just a bedrock of character that is terribly individualistic, that survives the ravages of disease, and that in some cases is most manifested during them, and a kind of just absolute bullheaded insistence on as much life as she could have, as many seconds of it when it got down to it, was part of just the basic nature of my mother. Mm-hmm. And as much as I wanted to budget for her good and my good into a personality or a temperament that could accept the inevitability of death and her own mortality, I was unsuccessful in my every attempt to do that. And as much as it was very painful at the time for me not to be able to inch or persuade or cajole her into some more peaceful acceptance of coming death, in retrospect, I very much respect her stance.
You and your father were both with your mother when she died. This was in the hospital.
Yes.
You and your father were smiling as your mother died. What brought on the smile?
What brought on the smile, it was actually, it's hard to define in her case, the actual moment of death. It was because there was a period of time when she stopped breathing that we thought was death. And her body became totally serene. And there was light shining in a window, through a hospital window, onto her face. And then we saw that that beam of light had landed at a point in her neck where there was this pulse. And the pulse was the only thing that existed in that room for a certain number of minutes. A body in complete tranquility, not breathing, and yet this pulse of life. And I can't tell you why we smiled. It was an instinctive response, and it was, in some ways, a beautiful sight. The moment that pulse stopped was not a beautiful sight. It felt like death. It felt like a spirit had departed, a person was gone. And it was a very different emotional, visual experience than that previous second. I mean, it was startling to me. I never could have anticipated the starkness of the difference between the moment before that pulse stopped and the moment after that pulse stopped. But there was, for which I am very grateful, that interval of peacefulness.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the things we're talking about are really very, very private affairs. I'm wondering what led you to want to share some of these thoughts in your memoir.
The experience, I mean, I had a very distinct reason for wanting to do this, both a personal one and one having to do with other people. The experience of a family going through the terminal illness of one of its members is so intense and claustrophobic and extreme that the degree to which you're engaged in it, you are very isolated and separate from the rest of the world. And then the death happens, and the bell, it's as if a bell jar rises and you're thrown back into the world. And it's very hard to integrate the period before the death with the period after the death, because there is usually the demands of an ongoing life. You have to be, you know, back in the office or addressing the needs of your own children. I was in an unusual situation, for better or worse, which was that after the death of my mother, there were no compelling demands upon me. And in a way, I had the luxury to spend the time trying to assimilate the intensity of what had happened. So I went back to the journals that I had kept during that period, and I had not been thinking of them for publication when I kept them. But I went back to those journals and began working with them and seeing if they couldn't be turned into something that could be sent out into the world. And I worked for two reasons, partly because I spent about 18 months working on the journals, which was about the period of time between the diagnosis and death of my mother, and I literally almost relived day by day the whole experience. And by the time I had gone through it a second time in words and in imagination and by reliving it, I was much, much more peaceful with what had happened. And I thought that perhaps by turning these journals into a book, they could almost work as an aid to meditation for other people who have been through this process, who whether they wished to or not, ended up blocking it out because there was just no way to incorporate it into the ongoing life after a death. I mean, everything pushes you to forget it, to put it in the past. So I hope that people in reading this book would be able to some extent, relive an experience that may have happened in their own life that they did not have the luxury, as I did, to reckon with and assimilate, and that it might provide a second opportunity for them.
Leanne Schreiber's memoir, Midstream, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on President Bush's revealing of the budget today?
Terry, this is always a big day in Washington. This is where rhetoric turns into reckoning, where political promises hit the bottom line and are expressed in dollars and cents, so we're taking a good long look at it. There have been some defense cuts, base closings. We're going to look at what is going to happen to the deficit, and we're going to look at the political prospects for Mr. Bush's plans. All the usual suspects, Terry. As well as more on the Avianca plane crash. The safety investigators know a little bit more now. And a single individual who can turn a bad high school into a good high school.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The PBS Public Affairs series Frontline had been working on a documentary about Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega when the United States invaded Panama, captured Noriega, and brought him to this country to face trial. Frontline moved almost as quickly, updating and completing its Noriega profile so it could be televised months ahead of schedule. The show, titled The Noriega Connection, airs this week, and television critic David Bianculli has a review.
Near the beginning of the Noriega connection, there's a quote from a speech in which the President of the United States launches an international war against drugs. But it's not the president you might be expecting.
Our goal is the unconditional surrender of the merchants of death who traffic in heroin.
This program, researched by Marcia Vivanacos and Frontline producer Charles Stewart, traces Noriega's activities and his relationship with the American government back to the 60s and even further. While Nixon was declaring war on drugs, State Department and CIA officials were refusing to indict Noriega on drug smuggling charges, even though they thought they had enough evidence to convict him. It wasn't Nixon's fault. In fact, Nixon was so mad that Noriega had gotten away that he sent a member of his old plumbers unit, you remember the plumbers, to Panama, to await orders to assassinate Noriega. The order was never sent, but Nixon and the plumbers weren't the only ones to cross paths with Noriega. It's like a who's who of modern political controversies, and Noriega is right in the middle of all of them. According to this documentary, Noriega was getting $100,000 a year as a CIA informant while George Bush was head of the CIA. Noriega was the man assigned to protect the Shah of Iran when Jimmy Carter diverted him to Panama. Noriega was an ally of Oliver North's during the Reagan administration, and so on. Most of this stuff has surfaced since Noriega's fall from power, but what this program does is explain in great detail how Noriega was able to get away with it for so long. The program's most damning testimony comes from CIA and Drug Enforcement Administration agent John Bacon, who talks about Noriega's escape from American prosecution in the early 70s. Bacon also says that federal files relating to Noriega in Panama were intentionally removed and presumably destroyed by someone in the Carter administration.
What I believe is the most probable is that since this was during the congressional debate on the Canal Zone treaty, which was being debated at that time, that the Carter administration did not want information damaging to consideration of the treaty to be made available.
This frontline also gets the inside story from former U.S. attorneys, from former associates of Noriega's, and from Roberto Eisenman, publisher of Panama's opposition newspaper.
Every country in the continent has a drug problem. Every country in the world has a drug problem. No other country in the world has this kind of problem, where the formal military institution, the uniformed authority, is actually controlled by the multinational narco-mafias.
The Noriega connection is a little dry. Can you imagine a glossy network documentary in which someone uses the words multinational narco-mafias? But this just-the-facts, ma'am, approach is just right in this case, because the facts are disturbing enough.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Dan Lachlan, and Thad Kirk. Chris Bergen and Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, white South African writer Rion Malan. He opposes apartheid. He's also the descendant of apartheid's chief architect. Also, actor Kurtwood Smith on playing the bad guy. Smith was the psychopunk in RoboCop. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.